used to like to play Daniel Boone and dash around the woods and lie down and brush the spiders off the water and drink the creek water. And I came up with a terrific tummy ache and high fever and delirium. And the old country doctor came, my mother called him, and he came, and he decided I had typhoid fever. And I remember vividly he put down his big satchel and his fedora hat and looked at me and told my mother I had typhoid fever. And she said, "Oh my God, what'll we do?" And he said, "Well, I want you to," and he laid out very specific instructions. And the window was to be open 6 inches, not more or less. And I was to have orange juice strained through 3 layers of gauze, not 2. Multiple directions like that. And that's all he had, really, in retrospect. And he had some bitter medicine that was, I learned later, was elixir, iron, quinine, and strychnine, which is a kind of a tonic in use in those days. And you got 9 drops for typhoid, 8 drops for influenza, 7 drops for otitis media. So, but he walked so close to God, and my mother said, "Will he live?" And he said, "Ma'am, we're going to pull this boy through." Well, I couldn't die. I couldn't let Dr. Van Pelt down. And I think that that image remained with me, the old country doctor, and how close he was to the Lord.
You were just a young boy.
Yes, yes. I didn't know then. When I went to a classical high school, worked to get $120 tuition to go to it, with 4 years of Latin, 2 years of Greek, a semester of writing poetry and so on in Cincinnati. And I planned to teach Latin and Greek and later on. And the second person who influenced me heavily was a chemistry teacher at this high school. I had, as you might guess, I was very much interested in what I was studying and had good grades. And I got a very low grade in chemistry in the first quarter. And I went to see him and said, "I don't understand it." "Well," he said, "you're one of those classical guys." He said, "You won't get your hands dirty. You'll never amount to anything." And so I thought, "Well, you so-and-so, I'll show you." So I buckled down and hit the chemistry and came out a scientist instead. And the interesting thing about it, later on when I got an honorary degree from Xavier University, where I went, he called me to congratulate me. And I said, "Sir, you don't congratulate me. I thank you. Because you turned me from a class assistant to a scientist."
This was back in high school?
Yes, yeah, junior year in high school, yeah. And then that's what made me want to go into medical school. And I intended to be a family doctor in northern Kentucky, southern Ohio at that time. And Dr. Vondre up there was our anatomy teacher. And when I was in the internship, it occurred to me that the only thing that really got me excited in medicine was the things relative to the nervous system. So I went to him.
Well, why was that?
I don't know. It was just, I was on surgery as an intern, and I didn't care what kind of incisions they made to get out the appendix or what kind of retractors they used. I was intrigued by the referred pain and how it got out to the skin from the vermiform appendix. And I went to see Dr. Vondre, and he told me, he sent me to the Boston City, the Harvard unit in neurology, and the Pennsylvania Hospital for Psychiatry. In those days, one trained in both. And I'm very much indebted to him for getting me started in this way.
Dr. Vondre is the man who really got you interested in neurology.
Right, yeah. Actually, he taught a course in neuroanatomy, and I took that as a sophomore. That was, of course, at that time, at Christmas time, I always picked up some Latin and Greek and an old English novel to read in the Christmas holidays. And I was going out of this medical school past the library, and I dropped in and just to browse for a moment. I came across a book, The Form and Function of the Nervous System by Tilney and Riley. And it was about yay thick and about 2 inches thick and quite a tome. And I took it home, and I was intrigued by it because it had the embryology of the nervous system, some evolution of the nervous system, anatomy, some physiology that was known at that time, plus clinical implications. And I read that book from cover to cover, and I came back and took the final exam in their anatomy and got quite a high grade. And this is what got me in touch with Dr. Vondre and where my interest was in the nervous system.
You were still studying the classics when you were at Xavier?
Yes, yeah, and in medical school too.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah. I hope now that I've retired, I've taken a look at the Greek and I can't, that would be awful hard to master again.
Uh-huh.
Latin, I think I can get back again. And I have some old novels I want to read again.
Hmm.
And it's sort of a full cycle, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I haven't even entered that cycle. I'm afraid I don't know any Greek or Latin either. What about your time at Boston? And you were an intern there, right?
That was a fascinating time. I was first-year resident, house officer in neurology, neurosurgery, they called it in those days. And at that time, Dr. Merritt and Dr. Putnam were experimenting and finding Dilantin, which is still the most important drug in the treatment of epilepsy. Dr. Lennox was doing his work on the genetics of epilepsy. EEG was a experimental tool at that time. And Dr. Gibbs had in his lab a map of the United States with the pins in it where the EEG machines were. I think there were about 6 or 8 at that time. This was in the fall of 37. And nowadays, of course, we have more machines than that in the Department of Neurology here, and so do most other large departments of neurology in the country. And it was not yet a proven entity, but it was an exciting place to be because at EEG, the yield is highest in the field of epilepsy.
Hmm.
See, there were 3 EEG groups in Boston at that time. Hallowell and Pauline Davis were at the Boston Psychopathic. And if you do 2,000 manic depressives or schizophrenics, you get a slightly higher incidence of some abnormality, a little slowing, but nothing definitive. And Bob Schwab was over at the Mass General, where they had a lot of neurosyphilis and strokes and multiple sclerosis and so on. But Gibbs and Gibbs were at the Boston City, where there was a lot of epilepsy. And in fact, one of the doctors and some of the technicians had seizures. And almost any head that you pasted the electrodes on, you got sparks out of. And so that this was this is where the action was at that time.
It just happened that you got involved with the people who were studying epilepsy.
That's right, yes.
You didn't go there with the idea?
No, I went there because it was, I was sent there because it was the top place to go in neurology at that time. I didn't know. I mean, Dr. Vondre figured that out for me. And I helped hold some of the cats for the original studies on Dilantin.
Mm.
The story behind that was that Dr. Merritt and Dr. Putnam were, we only had phenobarbital and bromides in those days for treatment of epilepsy. And the mother would come in with little Willie, her son, and they'd say, has he had any seizures? And she'd say, no, kind of whimsically. And he'd say, well, isn't that good? She'd say, well, I think it's better if he woke up once in a while. Because they had to sedate them so much.
Very heavily.
Yes. So the question came in. I suspected it was Dr. Putnam who got the idea. I'm not exactly sure of that. But I think it was Dr. Putnam's original idea. Dr. Merritt did much of the spade work on it. But the question was, is it necessary for a medication to be a sedative in order to be an anticonvulsant? Are these two separate factors? Now, at that point in time, the pharmaceutical industry was busy looking for new sedatives, and the chemist would cook up a formula, they'd boil it up and make it, the pharmacologists would try it, and if it didn't work, they retired it. So they went to the drug house and said, give us the samples and formulas of the sedatives that don't sedate.
Mm.
They took them back to the Boston City, they took some cats, gave them electroshock to determine the amount of juice it took to give those cats a seizure, then began to stuff these sedatives into them.
Mm.
And they came out with 3 that were quite effective, and the best one of those was Dilantin. It was introduced on the wards in January of 38, and was published in the JAMA Journal in June of 38 and went on the market in July. And that was a great breakthrough, so it was a non-sedative anticonvulsant.
It's a good strategy there, yeah.
Yes. That was the beginning of neuropharmacology, really. There was no, the term wasn't used in those days. And but the, you see, the way bromides were introduced about 1867 or thereabouts, a Dr. Sivaking read a paper in London before the Medical Chirurgical Society, and he told about, he had a list of the things that had stopped the seizures in his patients. Well, you didn't need a biostatistician to tell you he didn't have anything. Mm-hmm. Some had antimony, some had opium, they had all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. No common denominator. And Dr. Locock, who was in the chair that night, Sir Charles Locock, commented in the discussion of the paper that we all know that epilepsy is due to excessive sexual desire. Mm-hmm. So he was giving an anti-aphrodisiac, and it had stopped the seizures, and that was bromides.
It was.
Yes. Oh. And so it was on that false theory. The next one was Hauptmann, who I knew as a refugee in Boston. In the year I was born, 1912, when the barbiturates came along, he said, bromides are sedatives, barbiturates are sedatives. Bromides stop seizures, ergo. So he gave barbiturates, and the Lord loved him, because he didn't pick Veronol, he by accident picked phenobarbital, which is the best barbiturates, the highest anticonvulsant factor of all the barbiturates, so the Lord loved him. And then it was 25 years before the next step, the Dilan. So it was a very exciting place to be at that time.
So you got started in neuropharmacology?
Well, yeah. To some extent, yeah. I mean, that really isn't my forte. I did a lot of drug testing, various medications through the years, but I don't, I'm not really a pharmacologist.
I guess you've kind of directed yourself toward the clinical practice of neurology.
Yes, yes.
Where did that direction come from?
Well, in those days, you took a year of psychiatry. It was customary to train in both. And it took me about 6 weeks to find out that was not my forte. And I finished the year with credit and so on. Wasn't comfortable in it. It bothered me that you could sit and talk to a patient, come up with a diagnosis, and there was no way to prove it. There was no EEG, no X-ray, no autopsy, no surgery. What you called it, it was. And this was like in the recent violent crime, the Hinckley case, of the man who shot Reagan. And you can get two different opinions and can't reconcile them,
So it wasn't so much as the patients, it was hard to deal with them as the uncertainty.
The uncertainty of the field. Coming specifically off of a busy neurology service with the EEG being developed, and where the difference between seizure types could be made by EEG and so on, this was an exciting, and the contrast was so great. Mm-hmm. So I went back as chief resident of the Boston City then for a year, and then after that I went to New Haven for a year, physiology of the brain under Fulton, and then went into teaching.
Yeah, you'd made a stop somewhere along the lines in Philadelphia and Yale.
And then I taught for a short time at Boston University, and I was sponsored by Jefferson Medical College for the Rockefeller Fellowship at Yale, and the dean had died at Jefferson, and there was a hiatus in making appointments to the faculty, and so I taught at Boston U for a short time, and then went to Jefferson, and stayed there about 8 years. And then went to Georgetown to develop the Department of Neurology. I was the first chairman of neurology there. And then I made a small mistake professionally. I became dean of the medical school.
You said you made a small mistake.
To get into administration.
Uh-huh.
And then after 5 years, I resigned that and came here to head the Department of Neurology here in 1958.
Well, I'll have to ask you some more about that. I guess I'm still interested in also what the early training and research you were doing. You were working, I guess, with Fulton at Yale for a year. And did you still
think it possible that you might become a researcher?
No, I wanted to. I was primarily planning on going into academic clinical neurology,
mm-hmm.
but I wanted the research experience to understand the discipline of research and so on. And I think that in retrospect now, I think we often make the mistake of separating research and practice, and you can do both. You can use research techniques very effectively in practice. I think that the skill of learning the research techniques, skills learned, can be applied. I mean, well, even in medical legal matters, am I going too far astray for you?
No.
I mean, I don't know whether you know or not, I was involved in the Jack Ruby trial when he shot Oswald, you know. And a district attorney called me from Dallas and said he wondered if I would look at the EEGs on one of his clients.
Mm.
Well, I said, I know who your client is, you know, because I'd heard Belli say about the convulsive movement of the finger of Ruby on the gun when he shot, and I knew they were going to try to make him out to be epileptic.
Mm.
And I, of course, was opposed to that, biased against it, because I didn't think he was epileptic. If that was a psychomotor seizure, it was so prearranged. He got himself to be not considered unusual around the police station and so on. He hung around, brought pastrami sandwiches for the officers and so on, so he became part of the fixtures. And he ascertained the exact moment and so on, and he came out, as you all saw on TV, and shot Oswald. If this had been a psychomotor seizure, which they were trying to make out, he would have walked in the front door blazing guns or something of that sort.
It does
and
seem
killed
a bit
him.
Far-fetched.
Yes, yeah. But and besides, patients were being laid off and sent home from school because they might do something. And so I had a bias. So the way to get around it was to use a research technique. I told him I would look at the records provided. I had an indeterminate number of records run on the same machine. And so I read them one after the other. I didn't see the stack. The stack was in the next room. And I read them, and then after I did five, they said, well, you're finished. And I knew that I had read Ruby, you see. And so I didn't read it knowing whose record it was, and he did not have epilepsy.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a kind of an example. And given a test dose of medicine to a patient some time ago to be sure to find out whether or not he could take it, because sometimes it nauseates people. And the medical student inadvertently and naively told the patient, we want you to take this, we want to know whether it makes you sick to your stomach. Well, it made him sick to his stomach. Instead, then we put it in, it was a tablet. The next time we gave it to him, put it in a capsule and told him it was something different. And that time it made him sick too, so he was sensitive to the medicine.
Mm.
Yeah. So I think that using these extra little, the simple, you know, it's kind of a simple sort of thing. It's a kind of an example of using
that. Well, I guess that's what the idea has always been about scientific medicine, that you're supposed to do research
and learn
as a clinician.
Yeah, and see, much of my work in EEG in the last 14 years or so has been in reflex epilepsy, the seizures that are brought on by certain stimuli, like listening to a particular kind of music or flashing lights and that sort of thing. Well, I think my contribution there was not just to have the patient in and have an EEG done. So often the technician tastes on the buttons, pulls the curtains, the patient lies back in an easy chair, closes his eyes, rests quietly, and they turn on and run the machine for the prescribed number of minutes and certain montages, turn it off and have overbreathe, and that's it. I think it's important if the patient has seizure under certain conditions to reconstruct the conditions
mm-hmm.
as well as one can, you
mm-hmm.
know, and prove whether or not this does really evoke the seizure. We use the term action EEG for that. It's EEG during action,
mm-hmm.
appropriate action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, where was it that you first started teaching? Was that in Boston when you came to be an instructor there?
Well, actually, as a chief resident in neurology at the Boston City, I was an assistant in neurology at Harvard,
mm-hmm.
so that I did a little bedside teaching then.
Mm-hmm.
And then in New Haven, I didn't do any, because I was in the research, and I was a neophyte then. But then at Boston U, I was an instructor in neurology, and then at Jefferson, an assistant professor.
What kind of subjects did you have responsibility?
I had the responsibility for the whole course in clinical neurology. I never will forget the lectures. I I worked like a Trojan. I wrote out the first lecture longhand and tried it on my wife. And she was on peripheral nerves. And I got all finished. She said, well, it sounds good, but how long are you supposed to lecture? And I said, an hour. And she said, dear, it took you 6 minutes. So I had a stretch of the lecture. And,
right.
Actually, you know, I think I earned my spurs as a teacher there, or the beginning of it. In those days, teaching was largely, was pretty much lectures. And so I didn't dare leave time for questions. I was afraid for the first four or five lectures. By that time, I began to feel that I at home with the class. So I stopped the lecture a few minutes early and asked for questions, and there weren't any. So about the seventh lecture, I stopped a good 5 minutes beforehand and asked for questions, and there weren't any. And I said, now, you know, if you don't ask questions, I must have made this so clear and lucid that I can ask you anything on the exam that I've told you. Mm. After that, I had questions.
Yeah, that gets a response. Yeah.
Then I gave the lecture on polio about the 10th lecture, and I was fielding questions. And I asked for questions. And one of the students in the back said, doctor, how often do you see paralysis of one arm and of the opposite leg? And I said, I don't know that, but let's look it up after class, and we'll report back next week. And I drew applause from the students, because I guess in those days it was customary. Well, now there are various authorities, and some people give 5 minutes, you know, but it varies, and that sort of, but I can't cut it clean, you know. And I was elected to the Beg Society, which was a student faculty society that sat around at night with a stein of beer, and the students gave a paper and the faculty discussed it and so on, and it was, that was an honor to right after that I made the Beg Society.
So that was thanks to the student support.
Yes. Oh yeah, yeah, that was, yeah.
At Jefferson, maybe you could tell me a little bit about how you went about, I guess you set up an EEG laboratory there.
Yes.
How did that fit into what you were doing?
Well, yeah, that was a golden period of my life. I think the last 5 years and the years at Jefferson were the best periods of my life in many ways professionally. The years at Jefferson, I was brought there to develop the EEG lab and to help in teaching. I was the only full-time member of the department. And one of the few full-time faculty members in the clinical years, and in those days, and I set up an EEG lab. I did the routine neuropathology, gross and microscopic, including the surgical neuropathology, and I was allowed to take time to do research. I did some neurophysiological studies at that time, and I had to do my share in clinical teaching. Because the EEG, I was young and not completely mature by any manner of means in the field. And I realized I was beginning to overread the EEGs because the patients who were being sent for EEGs, they had their headache patients, or their patients who with a neurosis and they thought something was wrong with their brain. And the doctor sent them over for an EEG, and they had, this not much in the way. I wasn't seeing the sparks, so I set up an epilepsy clinic in order to get a more active EEG laboratory, and one that I'd understand. And then along came the drug house representatives and suggested that I might want to try some new medications, so I got into the drug testing. And of course, once you get involved with patients, that's a responsibility. Pleasant responsibility and the care, and you don't just drop them, you know, and you're at their beck and call. So that was, but in a way, I could do it. And when I went in the morning, I commuted by train and read a journal on the train, and then would walk about 6 or 7 blocks across Philadelphia to the hospital. And when I was walking over, I'd figure out what did I feel like doing today. If I felt contemplative, I'd do some neuropathology. Or do some work on a paper I was writing, both in neuropathology and neurophysiology and EEG and clinical neurology. So whatever I felt like that day, you know, of course, if I had a clinic, I was tied to a certain schedule, but by and large, I wasn't.
That's nice.
That's beautiful. Yes. And I wrote a lot. I had no intention of becoming primarily an epileptologist. And as a matter of fact, when I left Yale, my mentor there, Dr. Nims, suggested, he said, if you really want to get famous, develop some gimmick, some technique, and just work it for all it's worth. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm going to be eclectic, I want to do it. And so I wrote on all kinds of things in the early days, but I drifted gradually into epilepsy because mm-hmm. it just absorbed me, you know, but I didn't set out to do it. You know.
The same way that, I guess, you said you were brought to Jefferson to work to develop the EEG
yes.
lab, but
yes.
not to set up an epilepsy center,
no.
which came
no.
later.
No.
And Dr. Bernard Alpers,
yes, uh-huh.
well,
yeah.
how did he...
He was the chairman of the department mm-hmm. at that time, and he's the one in the second picture, the third column, down
uh-huh.
with the glasses, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
He was the one who wanted to have you
yes.
come into
yeah.
this.
He met me, you see, he was a neurologist. He had his office at the Pennsylvania Hospital, and when I was a young resident in psychiatry, he was a neurological consultant for the hospital, too, and so he met me, he saw some of the patients I had, and he liked me, and was impressed by me, and offered me a post.
Mm. And then you saw, I guess, your first case of reflex epilepsy while you were there?
Yes, at Jefferson.
That was a person who came into your clinic there?
Yes. Uh-huh. That was a little girl, Aunt Brady was her name, and she was about 4 years old, and whenever she was tapped briskly on the left shoulder, she would fall, and she'd lose consciousness just for a fraction of a second, and I could not get that under control. She also had some focal motor seizures, which I could control with medication, and I took her to Dr. Penfield, whose picture's on the bottom in the fourth column there.
Mm-hmm.
He was a great professor in neurosurgery at McGill, and the head of the Montreal Neurological Institute, the man who did so much in surgery and epilepsy. And Dr. Penfield operated on her. It's an interesting thing. I saw this little girl in my clinic at Jefferson, and I told the mother that I had done all that I could do, and I thought the child would profit by surgery. And she said, all right, when will you do it? And I said, well, I don't do surgery. And she said, well, who will? And I said, well, you know, we're not doing it here at Jefferson at this time. There are only two places. One is to go to Dr. Penfield in Montreal. The other one is to go to Dr. Earl Walker at Hopkins. And she said, where would you go take Anne if she were your daughter? And I said, well, they're both very competent people. But I think that Dr. Walker's just moved to Hopkins. He's just getting started there. I think I would go. And she said, we'll do it. And I said, look, can you afford it? And she said, doctor, this is our problem, not yours. So I asked a social worker to talk to him, and it turned out she had about 8 or 9 kids. Her husband was a milk truck driver at about $45 a week. They had about a nickel left over for a small beer at the end of the year, you know.
Yeah.
And she had she told me when I got the social worker, she said, look, I said, where will you get it? She said, well, I can go back to household finance. We paid off our bill for our son Francis for his rheumatic fever. For $1,000, I can go back and get some more. So I thought, oh, no. So the social worker went into it and found out that this really was a deserving family. And so I went to Blue Cross of Pennsylvania and asked them to pay the bill in Montreal. And they said, are you out of your mind? And so I explained it to them. They said, well, all right, we won't pay for the x-rays or the EEGs. And Dr. Penfield said, well, we'll put that on research. And then came the question of how to get them up there. And there was a social worker in town, or a lady in a Catholic parish in town, who was, I don't know where, but the priest had a little extra money, and he would have her go around and look for worthy causes, and our social worker knew about it. So she came in to see us, and I walked this little girl and tapped her on the shoulder, and she fell on the floor, and a lady opened her purse and said, how much does it cost to go to Montreal?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they got the whole thing for free, you know, and I...
Yeah.
I've kept track of Anne periodically through the years, and she's remained seizure-free. She's married. Unfortunately, the marriage is broken up, as so many of them have, and that's through no fault of the epilepsy. I had nothing to do with it. You know.
Well, and then you worked somewhat with Dr. Penfield and with Dr. Jasper.
Well, yeah, I showed this girl at the Eastern EEG meeting in Philadelphia, and they were interested in her. And then I went up there for the surgery, and I was around there at that time. And you know, it's an interesting thing. I only had a few weekends with Dr. Penfield and Dr. Jasper, but if the soil is right, you can absorb an awful lot in a short time, you know. And I think the same was true on my visit to Russia. The soil was right, but this is where I got the idea of the reflex epilepsies. I'd seen some of them in the past. I had a musicogenic epilepsy at Jefferson, and I had some photosensitive patients at Georgetown. But the visit to Russia, after my first impression was when they were talking about Ivan Petrovich Pavlov and so on, that they were still ringing the bell and the dog was drooling. And then after a while I began to realize these are smart guys, you know. And the Russian literature has to be translated from Russian to English, then it has to be translated for their way of presenting things to ours, you know. So that it's a double translation, and if you just look at it and without doing that, it doesn't quite make sense. Mm-hmm. And then I wondered if by chance these reflex epilepsies were naturally occurring conditional reflexes, and eventually proved that they are not. But that led to a way of treating them with behavioral methods and desensitizing them. So, but the soil was ripe. Also, it was a time I was over there. I had moved here in September of 58 and went over to Russia in November of 58. And I had not yet gotten established in any research project. You know, if you're doing research, you go along and you got these confounded experiments. You do one more cat. If you do one more, it's going to settle it. Then it doesn't. The cat dies in the experiment. And you can't get rid of it. You know? The advantage of moving is that you break off and you start something new and different. Mm-hmm. And so I had not yet planned what I was going to start. So while I was over in Russia, I had lots of time to think. And on the way back on the plane is when I got this idea. And so I could start de novo and forget all those other beasts with it.
I've always liked that feeling of starting somewhere fresh. Yes. Well, you've had a chance to do that several times. I'm wondering, it was World War II went on while you were at Jefferson. Did that affect neurology at all? Were there, as World War I did, I guess war injuries often lead to a lot of neurological
seizures and so on. Their surgery prospered. Certainly had developed faster then.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the development of the antibiotics made a tremendous difference too, and from the surgical approach. And for disease like, syphilis of the brain just disappeared, thank God, because of the penicillin.
Let me see. While you were at Jefferson, you started getting involved in some of the professional organizations of neurology.
Yes.
And you've been doing a lot of that, I take it.
I did, yeah. I got that, yeah. Yeah, it all started with the section on neurology and the section on nervous and mental diseases of the AMA. In 1948, I was elected secretary of that. And that was largely through Dr. Vondre, who was, again, his influence. And that, of course, led me to get meeting more people. And I got involved with the other three of the four horsemen. The four horsemen were Baker and Dr. Baker at Minneapolis and the University of Minnesota, DeYoung at Michigan, Saws at Iowa, and myself then, and by that time at Georgetown. And we were the young activists, believe it or not, agitating for the development of neurology. And in those days, everybody was certified in almost everybody in both neurology and psychiatry. And we used to say that many of the neurologists made fun of psychiatry but made their living out of it. And it was grave questions whether one could make a living in neurology. And that, of course, is obviously true now, because there are about 60 neurologists in the state of Wisconsin alone.
I remember when something of yours I was reading, it was in 56, you were talking about this, and you said that in the late 40s, medical neurology appeared to be losing its identity because it's almost swallowed up by psychiatry.
Yes.
And I take it since then that hasn't proved the case.
No. Oh, that was the establishment of the American Academy of Neurology that had a lot to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
And,
which I noticed you were secretary of that for a while. And take it president in the 50s.
Well, when we put it together in 48, everybody, those of us who were active in it, said what we wanted. And of course, Baker was going to be president. That was obvious. Yes, he was the key mover in it. And I asked for the chairmanship of the survey committee, and they said, "What's that?" And I said, "That's the committee that's going to find out where academic neurology is and what they need around the country." So I had the map with the pins in it. And this is when I was getting ready to look for a chairmanship. And they then went on to secretary and vice president, president-elect.
You were had your eyes open, and you ended up going to Georgetown.
Yeah, and that's a strange thing. I went to interview at a place. I won't mention the name of it in the east, and the school was split between two hospitals, and they didn't get along at all, and it would have been impossible to pull neurology together, and I went back. To Philadelphia, and when I got back, I had a letter from Georgetown. Georgetown didn't even show on the map. They didn't have enough to show on the map. And I went down to look at it, and that was a tremendous opportunity to establish a new department. And in Washington, there was so much available. You see, there was a D.C. general, which was called the Gallinger Hospital, and the VA. And when we ended up, I had part of the department at Bethesda Naval and Walter Reed at the D.C. General, the VA, and Georgetown. The only trouble is it took all day to drive around to see it, you know, especially with the traffic patterns.
Yeah, it sounds like that would keep you pretty busy.
It was. Busy time.
But you regretted the fact that you got caught up with administrative duties to this extent?
Oh, yeah, I learned a lot. You always learn, you know. I learned a lot from it, but I didn't get a whole lot accomplished in neurology at that time. I was inactive on project site visits for the Public Health Service, and when there were places where the dean was holding down neurology and wouldn't let it out from under medicine or psychiatry, I would be the one to go on those project site visits. Because I understood the dean's talk, you know, and they couldn't quite give me the malarkey like they could.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're just a neurologist, you don't understand the administration of the medical school. And I did, you know, and so that was but it was a price to pay, really.
I guess I'm surprised when I think about it that it took this long for neurology to really get established in this country. Why is that? You say it was eclipsed partly by psychiatry, but it's hard to understand, really.
Well, if you set out to do both, well, see, psychiatry originally consisted of the alienists testifying in court and the people who ran the quotes insane asylums, close quotes. The office practice of psychiatry fell to the neurologist. And if you look in the older textbooks, the textbooks around 1910 and so on, and 20, they have the chapters on epilepsy and so on. But as you get back in the end, they have a chapter on hysteria, on neuroses, neurasthenia, you know. So this was part and parcel. Now, the number of patients in psychiatry outnumber the neurology patients, and they're seen oftener. You know, the average epileptic patient who's a well-controlled, you see every 3, 4, 6 months, but you don't know, the hysterical. Now they see them oftener, so that the weight of the practice is predominant. Do you follow that?
Mm-hmm.
Then the other thing is, you got to get off your duff from behind the desk and get up and get out the reflex hammer and the ophthalmoscope and go over to the patient.
Mm-hmm.
In psychiatry, you don't do those things, you know, so you're sitting down, and and there's no EEG, no autopsy, no surgeon following you. you know.
But in this country, there's maybe it has something to do with popularity of psychoanalysis.
Yes. Yeah, that was, of course, at that time, too, that was at its heyday, you know, yes. And
that certainly isn't neurology.
No. Yeah. Oh, no.
Yeah.
No.
In a way, it almost seems like that would have encouraged the split between...
Yeah, and in those days, too, you see, there were psychiatrists had no medications.
Mm-hmm.
They had shock therapy, you know, but that was all. All of these psychotropic drugs is relatively recent.
Yeah.
And they abhorred the idea of giving a patient a prescription. That implies that there's something organic
mm-hmm.
about it, you see. You can't, it has to be, you know, a patient has to understand it's in their mechanism, mental mechanism.
Well, it reminds me of somewhere in one of the things you had written, you asked whether the distinction between idiopathic epilepsy and symptomatic epilepsy was going to be permanent, or whether eventually everything might be symptomatic of something rather than constitutional or undefined.
Yeah. Idiopathic, Dr. Martin Fisher, one of our great professors in Cincinnati, used to say that idiopathic meant essential ignorance.
Mm-hmm. May very well be.
Yeah.
But I guess the psychiatrists are stuck with an even worse case because so many of the things they study, they can't trace it to anything. Problem. Well, I guess that I'm curious how you managed to get as much done as you did. You wrote a lot. I know you have written a lot. When did you do your writing?
Well, we had five children, and I got conditioned to not to write till after the kids went to bed, about 10:30 or so. And I wrote when that first book that I put together, Modern Therapy and Neurology, came out in 55 or 56, I planned the book ahead of time. Picked out the men to write the various chapters, and I wrote the chapter on epilepsy. Talked them into it in late fall, and then around the first of the year began to send them letters, gave them a deadline. And by June 15th, I wanted the manuscripts, because something on treatment, if you diddle around with it for a year or two for one chapter, the rest of them are out of date.
Yeah.
And so it was a staccato drum beats, airmail special, telegram, phone calls, and I had all but one in on the 15th, and the rest were in on the 17th. That one came in on the 17th of June. Well, this was timing because it was during the summer, and I could take it a little easier at the university at Georgetown. So what I did was I start writing about 9 at night. I took a porch, a glassed-in, screened-in porch off of our bedroom and fitted it up with one of those flush doors for a desk and a sofa where I could lie down on if I wanted to. An easy chair, a dictaphone, a typewriter, a tape recorder, and and everything. I've got some bricks and planks and made of bookcases and put everything out there that I wanted. And so at 10 o'clock I'd close the door and go out there. At 11 my wife would come up with a pot of espresso coffee and two cups. We listened to the 11 o'clock news as it is in the East. And she had one cup of coffee, and I drank the pot of espresso.
Hmm.
Then about 3 in the morning, I'd go down and run around the block or listen to a symphony, go unwind, and then get up about 8 o'clock, have breakfast out on the terrace, and then go in about 9:15. So, and just round the way that summer.
That's pretty good if you can get along with those kind of hours.
I could do it then. Yeah. Yeah. About every 2 weeks, I'd sleep around the clock one night. And then I charge the battery.
Mm.
But now, as you get older, you can't get away with that 4 or 5 hours anymore.
Not everybody can do that. I don't think that's within my abilities to keep going out.
You know, one of the things too is you notice that I ran around the block or listened to a symphony or played the piano or something. When you go to bed, have you been working? And I don't mean manually planting flowers or something of that sort, but if you've been concentrating and writing or putting something together, break it and read something else or do something else, for just 15 minutes or so, and then you don't dream about it. Otherwise, you work the rest of the night.
Yeah, that's the worst thing.
This way you can break it.
Intellectual nightmares.
Yeah.
I've had those. Definitely not pleasant. What about, could you just tell me, how did you end up treating President Eisenhower?
First of all, I have an old friend, Knox Finley, in San Francisco, and he and I got in the habit of playing practical jokes on each other, kind of mean ones, like he canceled my room reservation for the AMA meeting in San Francisco, and in those days they didn't have any big hotels, and I had to sleep in a room with a shoe exhibit so I could get a room. And when I was out there one time, I was Mr. Moriarty from the Internal Revenue, and he had to get his books out for the last 5 years tomorrow morning and sort of thing. So that night in November, in the morning, it came on the radio that the president had had a chill during the night. He'd gone to the airport to meet the King of Morocco, and it was raining, and they stood outside, and he gave their speeches and so on in the rain. And he rode back in the open car with a top down, waving to the people, and in a chill. And I had a call from the White House and Colonel, would I come down and examine the president? Knox Finley, so and so. You know, you walk up to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, your little black bag, and you're at St. East. And so they said, well, look, we'll send the White House limousine if you'll come. I said, well, certainly. So I put on my hat and coat, and sure enough, the chauffeur limousine showed up in a few minutes, and that was it. And that was an interesting experience. The president had a small stroke in the branch of the left middle cerebral, and he is aphasic, not badly. I remember there was a picture of one of Turner's seascapes in his bedroom, and I said, Mr. President, what's that? You know, the testing for his aphasia. And Jim Haggerty, the press secretary, came in and he said, Jim, always said Mr. President that, and he gave the right name for it. He said, you always call it the smuggler. I said, that's it, smuggler. And every time I saw it, I said, smuggler. So, yeah, he nailed it down. And it was an interesting thing. That was the longest consultation, I guess. It took from about 10 in the morning till 6 at night. And one of the things that we very carefully wrote out, the news release on it, we agreed that we would not talk to the press. We wrote a careful news release, and that was it. And there were a couple of things in that. The word brain was used once, and I objected to that because I thought it was a little gauche to refer to the president's brain. And so the other thing was, I had had some experience. The last line of the last sentence says the president is in full possession of his faculties. Even though he was, I mean, he knew what he, you know, and he was aware and conscious and so on. I visited the Philippines in 52, and they were intrigued by neurology, the dean of the medical school, and so I trained their neurology. I have more friends in Manila than any other city I haven't lived in. But at any rate, they sent the Archbishop of Manila over to me, and he died on my service at Georgetown, and I wrote back a letter to the dean about it. And this was published in the Manila Times. Now, this is preamble. A few months later, the dean sent me a cablegram. He's bringing President Carino to Hopkins. So I get a cablegram that they're leaving on such and such a day. Cablegrams, they arrived in Hawaii. They were resting there. Then they had to go back to Hawaii for plane trouble. And finally, I got the feeling I'm supposed to meet that damn aircraft, you know. So, sure enough, they were going to Friendship Baltimore instead of the National Airport. So I drove up to Baltimore to meet the airplane, and it was a PAL plane. The pilot put the little Philippine flag out just as he landed, and they brought down President Carino. And Jerry Cisson, the dean, said, now I want you to come to Hopkins to examine the president. And I said, I can't do that, Jerry. He said, why not? I said, he's not the Hopkins doctor's here. Oh, he said he's my patient. He is now, but he ain't when he goes in the front door at Johns Hopkins. So, well, he said, well, I'll be back in my office. Here's the phone number. So I drove back from Baltimore to Washington to sit in my office to get a phone call from the Hopkins doctor. Would I please come up and examine President Carino? Certainly, I drove back up. It seems stuffy, but it's protocol, you know? Yeah. And they may not have wanted me, and it'd be a very embarrassing situation. But at any rate, so I examined him. He had nothing wrong neurologically. He had ulcers, stomach ulcers, and some problem with his legs. And so I wrote the negative neurological. My friend said, what about his mind? I said, well, he's okay. So why don't you put it down? I said, well, of course, present full possession. A couple weeks later, somebody, one of my friends, sent me a copy of the Manila Times. Dr. Francis M. Forster, physician of the late Archbishop Reyes, has declared the president competent. I wouldn't mind doing it, but I would have liked to know. Well, the point was that Lopez, the vice president, had bolted the party. This would be like if Bush became a Democrat now, and Reagan was out of the country for his health. Do you follow that?
Uh-huh.
So this was to offset any attempt by Lopez to take over the presidency. And so this was why I thought it was smart to put in that, wise to put in that little line, the president's full possession of his faculties, which he was.
When did that earlier incident happen?
About 53, yeah.
So you were still seeing the president for a couple of months?
Yeah, until February, yeah. It's interesting. He wanted to go to NATO shortly after that, and I was a little concerned. But he told me he's got to go to NATO because of being Supreme Commander before that and so on. So I sat down with the secretary, press secretary, and went over the list of activities. And I said, well, he can go to this, but he can't go to that. You know, and I said, well, yeah. I had a country boy from Ohio doing selling what the president can do or can't do. I was trying to put some limitations on the number of banquets and so on. And they said, well, now this one he has to go to. It was absolutely a must. It was a little drop. And the other thing was that they sent his car over, and I wanted him to send the bubble over for it. So the bubble would be bolted on. So it's raining all the time in Europe, and I didn't want him riding around the streets of Paris. This was before they moved to Brussels. I didn't want him standing out in the rain again after this last episode. And they told me that when he got over there and he saw that bubble on his car, who the hell put that on? Get that off. They had to unbuckle it and take it off before he'd go into town. But it was an interesting experience, too. And I don't know if I have it right here. But in the at that time in the White House in November, he showed me a picture that he was painting of Prince Charles of England. And I better not hold this up, but at any rate, he was painting this picture of Prince Charles, and it wasn't quite finished. And so I was in England last year at Christmas time. I thought I'd just stop by. I'd written ahead to the surveyor of art for Her Majesty the Queen, and wondered where this picture was, and got back this letter. But he's unable to locate it, and doesn't know anything about it. And so I looked around in the museums myself over there and couldn't find it. So I wrote to the Eisenhower Museum when I came back in Abilene, and there is a picture.
There it is.
Yes, it's a copy of it, and they sent along a letter and said that it was presented to the Queen on October the 17th. They had a list of the presents, and she was in, the Queen, and here it is. These are the presents that were exchanged between. Anyway, this is around here somewhere. A list of the presents that were presented to the Queen by Eisenhower and by the Queen to him. And that picture was listed on it. And so I wrote back, and they haven't found that picture yet. I don't know where it is. They haven't. But it's somewhere because I've got a copy of it.
Oh.
Isn't that interesting?
So it's a lost work by
Yes, but yes, I hope I'm instrumental in getting him to dig it out somewhere. I don't know whether it's in Gettysburg or whether John Eisenhower, the son, might have it, but it was never really given, although it was supposed to have been. Yeah.
Somebody slipped up.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, let me think. Maybe you could tell me immediately after this you came out here to Madison, and how did you happen to come here? Who brought you out here?
Well, Clint Woolsey was instrumental in that. Mm. You know, he was on the search committee for a new chairman of neurology. We were together on the council of, we were both on the council of NINDV and NIH. And so after one of the meetings, I guess we went to an American Neurological meeting, and then I came out here and was interviewed for the job. And I had resigned as dean at Georgetown, and then this opportunity came along. You know, when you quit as dean, a lot of times people think that the guy's slipping.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think I was going down. I thought I was going up by going back to my department. And I came out here and saw this. You see, if you look back over that, I went to a small Catholic college. The University of Cincinnati was a municipal university at that time. And Harvard and Boston and Pennsylvania were private, originally denominational, but not really in a large sense. Boston U was a denominational university. Jefferson was a proprietary medical school. Georgetown was a Catholic university. I'd been in everything but a state university. And I'd learned to put a department together without any real solid financial backing at Georgetown. So I figured that with that experience, I could do a whale of a job if I had a reasonable base of operation. And the department here, had been a department of neuropsychiatry from the founding of the medical school, when it became a four-year school, until 1956. And in 1956, Dr. Reese, who was the head of the department at that time of neuropsychiatry, they told him that they'd split it, and they set psychiatry aside, and he was now chairman of neurology only. And Dr. Reese was, I've forgotten the year he was born, but he played on the German Olympic soccer team and won the World Championship the year I was born, 1912. So he was pretty well along, you know.
Yeah.
And so he wanted to retire, and so that left the vacancy. And it was a small department with about three or four men, most of them doing neurology and psychiatry at that time. And they had two, three residents at the most. And this had all the potentials for growth and development, you know. Plus the fact that it's a great university, that the basic sciences were strong. And at that time, Ted Erickson was in neurosurgery, who had worked with Penfield and wrote the book with Penfield, which was a great attraction for me. And I came out and was interviewed, and didn't hear, so I thought, and I went off to the Orient for the Air Force, and I was in that Jerry Cison, the dean of the University of the Philippines, in his office, on a courtesy visit from Clark Air Base. And when he said, "I have a cablegram for you from John Bowers," John Bowers was dean at that time here, and the cablegram was that I had been chosen for the chair. So I called Helen back in Bethesda, and we used to always spend quite a time making up our minds about something like a move.
Mm.
Get out the big piece of yellow paper and draw it down, line down the middle, you know. Mm. And we'd find that after we talked for a while, we'd be saying if, and then the first thing you know, we'd be saying when, and that was it. Well, at $15 for 3 minutes, we couldn't afford that.
Mm.
So after a few moments, we said, well, let's go ahead and do it. So Helen came up and looked for a house and put our house up for sale in Bethesda. And I came home as soon as I could finish my mission for the Air Force. And we moved up here. And so that, And
what were you doing for the Air Force?
Oh, I was a national consultant to the Surgeon General from 55 until I retired just 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a fistful of hats, really, in those days. Actually, when I moved here, I was president of the Academy of Neurology. I was a consultant to the Surgeon General of the Navy, the Air Force, and the Public Health Service. And I was on the board of psychiatry and neurology. I guess I wasn't a president then. But I had an awful lot of things. And so, the most amazing thing is how I accomplished this.